We're going back one last time in our Luke series to chapter 8 of this gospel. So please turn to Luke 8. And here shortly I'll be reading verses 40 to 56. Luke chapter 8, verses 40 to 56. This week I was listening to an interview that was done with a Christian couple up in Virginia, and it had to do with their experience of what the world would call tragedy and of their learning to walk with Christ through some very difficult circumstances. And what happened was that without any anticipation throughout this lady's pregnancy, just a few moments after their son Declan was born, they were told by the medical people that he had Down syndrome. And that totally upended their world and their life really in a permanent way. And they were very frank about their struggles, but also about the grace of God and how the Lord has ministered to them through suffering. But listen to some of the things that they shared. This is from the wife. Her name is Janelle. Quote, Declan doesn't sleep well, has never slept well. So I was in his room, very dark, in the middle of the night, probably at 2 or 3 in the morning, and had been up with him already maybe 20 to 25 times. Readjusting him, repositioning blankets, pillows, body, whatever it was. That was the point that I felt the deepest anger and hopelessness that I've ever felt throughout the process of living alongside Declan. And what I was saying to God was, leave me alone. Just leave me alone. Because it felt so oppressive. And anybody knows lack of sleep can make your mind go to really hard, difficult, tortuous places. And so that was where we were. But nightly, every single night. And so that was the place that I was, the stark hole, wanting to just disappear from God's sight. And explaining to Tim, it was scary. This is her husband, who's actually a pastor. Explaining to Tim, it was scary, fearful to me. And through that explanation in that dark night, I told him at the very same time, I had this imagery of myself as a toddler standing in the corner, throwing a fit, kicking the wall, but still kind of looking over your shoulder to make sure your parent hasn't left. And her husband went on about that experience. And I remember her telling me this kind of wrestling with those thoughts. And she said, I want God to leave me alone. I want to run away from God. And then she stopped and she said, but where would I go? Where would I go? And so there's that deep comfort of knowing you're ultimately His and resting in Him, even in those moments where you're thinking, I don't know if I even like God right now. But I know He's good, and I'm going to rest on that. Well, those are the kinds of dire straits, the kinds of struggles, as well as the kind of ultimately faith response that we find in two stories that are combined together here at the very end of Luke chapter 8. If you think back to what we've seen in the second half of this chapter, this combination of miraculous works of Jesus up there in the area of Galilee, we have witnessed His authority over the natural realm. And the message over verses 22 to 25 was entitled, Lord of the Storm. Last week we saw Christ's authority over the supernatural realm, the realm of demons. And in verses 26 to 39, we considered that he is the conqueror of the darkness. And if you think about Lord of the Storm and conqueror of the darkness, you might be asking, well, the Lord can do all that. I mean, what is left? Well, we find these two other stories here, and they are combined together. One is sandwiched within the other. They're combined because they actually parallel each other in some important ways. And together, they teach yet another realm over which Jesus Christ has ultimate authority. You'll be looking for that as we read now. You can follow along as I read verses 40 to 56. Now, when Jesus returned, the crowd welcomed him, for they were all waiting for him. And there came a man named Jairus, who was a ruler of the synagogue, and falling at Jesus' feet, he implored him to come to his house. For he had an only daughter, about 12 years of age, and she was dying. As Jesus went, the people pressed around him, and there was a woman who had a discharge of blood for 12 years, and though she had spent all her living on physicians, she could not be healed by anyone. She came up behind him and touched the fringe of his garment, and immediately her discharge of blood ceased. And Jesus said, "Who was it that touched me?" When all denied it, Peter said, "Master, the crowd surrounds you and are pressing in on you." But Jesus said, "Someone touched me, for I perceive that power has gone out from me." And when the woman saw that she was not hidden, she came trembling and falling down before him, declared in the presence of all the people why she had touched him and how she had been immediately healed. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace." While he was still speaking, someone from the ruler's house came and said, "Your daughter is dead. Do not trouble the teacher anymore." But Jesus, on hearing this, answered him, "Do not fear, only believe, and she will be well." And when he came to the house, he allowed no one to enter with him except Peter and John and James and the father and mother of the child. And all were weeping and mourning for her. But he said, "Do not weep, for she is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him, knowing that she was dead. But taking her by the hand, he called, saying, "Child, arise." And her spirit returned, and she got up at once. And he directed that something should be given her to eat. And her parents were amazed. But he charged them to tell no one what had happened. As we read through that, I'm sure you picked up on the fact that the story about Jairus and his daughter was suspended in our version here in the middle of verse 42. And you don't really get any closure as to what happened because there's this other story, this other event that is inserted. And by the time that you come to verse 49 and the story about Jairus picks up, his daughter has died. You have the event about this woman with a hemorrhage that is placed in there, kind of interrupting the story and making you wonder, how is this all going to unfold? How is this all going to end for Jairus? But think about these two individuals. They happen to be females. And I made the point several messages ago about the emphasis that Luke has on Jesus and his compassionate ministry toward women. You have in the first case a woman who is plagued with a disease. And eventually you have a young lady, a 12-year-old girl, who falls prey to the greater problem, not of disease, but her sickness overtakes her such that she falls prey to death. And so you've got those two issues, disease and death, interacting in these stories. We talked about Jesus' authority over the natural realm and over the supernatural realm. Really, neither of those problems could actually be described as natural or supernatural. Disease and death don't fit well into either of those categories. You might think, well, sickness and death happen to us naturally, but we understand that those things really aren't natural to God's creation as he originally made it, and they are actually aliens to the human race. They don't belong to God's original kingdom, that they were brought in by God as a consequence of sin or as judgment. You and I, theologically, we call disease and death, we call them elements of the curse and experiences that hover over every one of us and touch us in one way or another, frightening us with those threats to our very existence. And Jesus Christ, in these stories, he compellingly demonstrates his authority over both of those oppressive problems that ultimately exist because of the curse. And so our theme this morning is reverser of the curse. Jesus Christ and his interactions with these two ladies is at work to reverse the curse and to point to his ultimate authority to do that for everyone who believes in him. And what we find here in this passage is like so many other passages of Scripture, where there is a combination of teaching or doctrine that is a description of something that is true about God and his ways. But woven all throughout that, there's also an element on the way to respond to the doctrine, the human response that is required to that theological truth about who Christ is. Or you could say that the indicative and the imperative are here side by side, woven all together throughout both of these stories, illustrated in the experience of these people. And so basically the way the message is going to break down is there's going to be a doctrine, there's going to be a great reality about Jesus Christ, and then there's going to be an emphasis, secondly, on the kind of response that that calls forth from us. What's the doctrine? It's not hard at all to capture, to summarize what is being said here in this story, and that is that Christ possesses authority over the curse of sin. That's the doctrine. Christ possesses authority over the curse of sin. He is that curse reverser. And this is not the first time in this gospel that you would have been exposed to that truth about him. There is background that should have been pointing you in this direction, going all the way back, for example, to the kinds of things that Zechariah said when he was praising the Lord for the coming of the Messiah and the birth of his own son to announce the Messiah. He described the coming ministry of Jesus in terms of a phrase from Isaiah, to give light to those who sit in darkness and in the shadow of death. And that's what's happening in this story. You've got really both of these women sitting in darkness and under the shadow of death. And Jesus comes and he shines his light on them to free them. Or Jesus himself, when he sort of formally introduced his ministry at the synagogue in Nazareth in chapter 4 of this gospel, in verse 18, he says, again quoting Isaiah, that the Lord has sent me to do what? One of the things is to set at liberty those who are oppressed. And here these people are oppressed by crippling disease and ultimately death, and Jesus comes and he works to deliver them mightily. And as you read the story, there are various ways in which the Lord is demonstrating his all-encompassing authority over these oppressions that we suffer under. And I want to point these out to you. First of all, he demonstrates his authority in terms of the objects of his miraculous work. That is, the people who experienced his deliverance and the circumstances that led up to what they were facing here in this chapter. Both of these people have been described for us as beyond all human help. That all the resources that could possibly be used to help rescue these people have run out. There's nothing left. Nobody can do anything. And so look at verse 43. As it talks about the woman, it says that she had spent all her living on physicians and she could not be healed by anyone. I'm sure that was a bit of a humbling comment for Luke to make, since he was a physician. Therefore, as smart and as effective as they might be in helping people with their sickness, there are plenty of things beyond their control that they have nothing that they can do to resolve. And Jesus steps in at the point where human help has dissolved. And of course, as far as the girl was concerned, maybe a doctor could have helped her through her disease somehow, but once she's dead, she is dead. Nobody is going to bring her back. This is something totally beyond the pale of human deliverance here. Only a direct divine intervention could change the circumstances of these people. And so we see the Lord's authority in terms of the objects of his work and their circumstances. Secondly, also in the timing of his miraculous work, the timing of it. Did you pick up on the parallel number of years that were mentioned about both of these women? Look at it in verse 42. It says that Jairus, his only daughter, was about 12 years of age, and it was precisely for that same amount of time, 12 years, verse 43, that this woman was suffering from some kind of hemorrhage that nobody could stop. 12 years. And basically, for as long as that little girl had been alive, this other woman had been suffering from this debilitating condition. They grew up, as it were, together, or were going through the same sorts of just general life experiences for about the same length of time, and they kind of mirror each other. You're supposed to bring them together and ask yourself the question, isn't that striking that it was both of them 12 years? This is all prearranged by a sovereign God who wants you to recognize that the Lord is working in similar ways in the lives of these people and the timing. And then as far as timing as well, the intentionality of Jesus, as the story goes on, when he takes time away from what would seem to be a much more pressing matter to stop the caravan and to indirectly confront the woman, to bring her out, and to speak to her personally. And it makes you wonder, how long did that take? How many people were there? Was there more interaction between Jesus and this woman? And what might have happened if Jesus had been walking a little bit faster and had just breezed on by? But he stopped. And he stopped long enough to where Jairus' daughter died. And so here he's helping one woman, but in effect he's letting another woman be taken over, totally conquered by this enemy, this curse of death. And yet, as you read the story, it's very evident the Lord was sovereign over that delay, that quote-unquote delay as well. He's demonstrating his authority in the timing. Nobody's going to tell him how and when he's supposed to work. He's going to do it not only what he wants and how he wants, but when he wants. He demonstrates as well his authority in his knowledge displayed through this miraculous work. And I'm thinking particularly about the fact that he was aware that somebody had touched him. Nobody had to tell him that. In fact, Peter questioned him on it. Nobody that we know of saw it to be able to point this out. He just perceived it. Someone touched him, and power went from me. He says, I perceive it there in verse 46. And this would have been a pretty unusual thing for him to be aware of under these circumstances. When in verse 42, it is describing the situation there, and it says at the end that the people pressed around him. Same term that is used when Peter brings this up, or a similar term. They are pressing in on you. Actually, the first word about pressing is used earlier in this chapter, back in the parable about the soils and the case where the thorns choked the little plant that was just coming up out of the ground. You might translate it, just to be a little bit vivid here, that the crowds were choking Jesus. It's maybe not exactly the same idea, but that gives you some sense of how suffocating this was, how big and overwhelming the crowd was. And when I was thinking about that right away, I thought about the experience that some of us had a few weeks ago in Mexico. And we were on that metro. I've tried to describe it to people. It'd be kind of like the platform here if you get everybody in the church up here to stand together. That's about how crowded we were. And the whole point of the thieves was that because you're getting pushed and pressed and touched by all kinds of people, you're not really attuned to any one of those people and what they might be doing to slip their hand in your pocket to take out whatever they want. And so some of us got ripped off. We said, who touched me under those circumstances? Well, a dozen people were touching us back and forth all over the place. And so Peter is like, why are you asking that question? Everybody's touching you here. So many people, we can hardly breathe. This is a suffocating experience. But Jesus demonstrates his authority in the circumstance by saying, no, one individual touched me, and that individual experienced something unusual because of that touch. And that brings us to the next evidence of his authority. And that's what we could call the effortlessness of the miracles that take place. He didn't strain himself, just really ramping up somehow his energy. He didn't pray to the Lord. He hardly did anything. Actually, in the first case, he was passive, and it was just a matter of somebody else touching him. He really, literally didn't do anything. Somebody else reached out, and they didn't even hug him and even touch his skin. It says that she touched the fringe, which might have been one of the tassels on the end of his cloak that, according to the law, these people were supposed to wear. Just a very light sort of a touch. And this happens. He didn't strain. He didn't work. It just took place without any effort. And what about the little girl that was raised from the dead? Again, it was connected with the touch idea. In that case, verse 54, he took her by the hand and he spoke to her what comes out here in English as two short words, child, arise. Again, no straining, no exertion of energy. And that touch issue would have been very significant and really a negative thing in this context. Because according to the law, both of these people would have been considered ceremonially unclean. People who were suffering from this kind of hemorrhaging, according to the book of Leviticus, you weren't supposed to touch them because you would, by extension, become unclean yourself. And so there was a lot of social kind of pressure that this woman was having to overcome to do what she did in stretching out her hand to Jesus. And of course, dead bodies were also considered unclean. And so that ceremonial uncleanness under normal circumstances would have transferred over to the person who touched. But Jesus, without saying anything really about that, without making some point, without working hard or explaining theologically, he doesn't become unclean. That uncleanness does not attach to him. Actually, his virtue cleanses the uncleanness and drives it away. And he hardly does anything. So there is the effortlessness of it. There's also the immediacy of it. That's another fact that demonstrates his authority, is how quickly the healing and the resurrection take place. And this is another point that Luke himself is bringing out and he's emphasizing for us. If you read, particularly in Greek, the description of this woman in verse 43, it's one of these sentences that goes on, and it is pretty rough grammatically. Usually when I work on these passages, I'm looking at the original language, I'm trying to chart it out in terms of the actual order of the words and the phrases of the passage, and this one was pretty challenging. It's actually kind of convoluted from the way that you might expect. And it just goes on and on. It's like interrupting the thought almost, and it's just kind of stretching out the description of her condition. And everything that you find said there in verse 43 and verse 44. And what it's doing, I think, grammatically, is building up the anticipation or the question of what's going to happen and how is this going to work out for her. And the resolution is stated very succinctly, different from the wording of the rest of the sentence. And it's just like, bang, here it happens at the very end. Immediately, her discharge of blood ceased, which is a word that means to stand still. And it kind of reminds you of the story about the storm, where just with a word from the Lord, just with a brief command, everything goes away. Immediately, the problem dissipates. That's the feeling you have here. It was very sudden. Nothing to kind of work up. No stages or steps that were followed right away. And when she describes what happened to her, she makes that point as well in verse 47 at the end, how she had been immediately healed. And the same term shows up in verse 55, though it's translated a little bit differently. It says, and her spirit returned, and she got up at once, or immediately. This happened all of a sudden. The problem was at once, with no delay, no prolongation, everything was resolved. You have a number of ways there where Jesus is demonstrating his authority. The objects of his miracle, the timing of it, his knowledge about the circumstance, the effortlessness, the immediacy of it, and finally, Jesus' control over it all. His control over it all. My point is that everything on his part was intentional in the way that he used his power. And this is something we want to keep in mind as we think about whatever else was going on that occasion or throughout the earthly life of Jesus. Just because he is God in the flesh and just because he can do things, it was not a carte blanche deliverance of everybody in that society who had problems. There were a lot of sick people that did not experience this kind of work from the hands of Jesus at this time. There were plenty of other people in Palestine during those years of earthly ministry that went on and kept suffering all of their lives with life-debilitating sicknesses and did not experience what the woman here received. There were also a lot of people who died in the process, and Jesus did not choose to resurrect everybody who passed away. Now, even when it comes to the woman, who seemed like she was conniving a little bit, doing something behind the scenes, trying to get this all to work to her advantage, you want to recognize that ultimately she is not somehow manipulating the Lord. She had her plan, but again, a lot of people were touching Jesus, and not everybody that touched him was delivered, not that day or any other day. You know, just kind of put your finger there and zap, your life is just hunky-dory from now on. Jesus, later on, and this is going to be our next point, he connects what happened to this woman's faith. It wasn't an automatic thing that if you just touch Jesus, like energy flows out of him to anybody, and automatically every problem is resolved. She was not manipulating him. And he also demonstrates his control in terms of Jairus. You realize Jesus did not do what Jairus wanted. He comes to him and he asks him to go heal his daughter who was dying, and Jesus lets her die. And yes, he has a plan to bring her back, but we take away from that, again, that you cannot manipulate Jesus. He is the one who determines who and when and how he is going to work. The Lord actually said no to Jairus' initial request, but as we have seen before, even in what the Lord told to the demoniac. You remember this from last week. Sometimes the Lord says no, but it's because he has a much better plan in mind for what he intends to do. The Lord's control is evident toward the end of the passage. in what may seem a little bit odd in verse 56 when he charges them to tell no one what had happened. And of course, I'm sure the word got out. There were other people there witnessing this as well. The word would have gotten out, but the point is Jesus is interacting with that whole situation, and the reason he wants to hold back the reports is that he does not want to be viewed as a mere miracle worker that people can flock to have all their problems taken away. That's not really why he came into the world. He is doing these things on purpose, yes, to help people in their problems, but he is doing it to demonstrate who he is. That's the point. I'm not just a candy machine here to give you whatever you want. I'm not a bank to pay all of your bills. I'm not some kind of miracle worker to take away all of your earthly problems right now. That's not the nature of my ministry. Don't box me in as some kind of just problem solver. I'm much greater than that. And don't miss the point. And he's actually going to limit his miraculous works so that that point is very clear. And that actually helps us with the application of a passage like this. Because we naturally read the story, and it's so remarkable, and it's so compelling, and we say, this is awesome. And I want Jesus to do this for me too. I want him to rescue me from some kind of malady that I've been suffering all my life. Or when I'm at the point of death, I want him to take it all away so I get another 20 years of life or whatever. Do you realize that everybody that Jesus healed in his earthly ministry and everybody that he ever brought back to life, they died eventually? Their deliverance was only temporary. And again, there's a point being made. The point of a story like this is not that Jesus is going to remove all my suffering in this life. The point is that he has the authority to remove the curse of sin. And sometimes when he deems fit, he chooses to alleviate the curse of sin here on earth. But he may not choose to do it on earth, but the assurance is he is the one who has the role and the authority to do it so that later in the Bible, when we read about him banishing all tears, all sickness, all suffering, and even death itself in the new world, we're assured, I can believe that. That's going to happen because one of the reasons in his earthly life, there were these little sneak previews of what he has authority to do. And even if here on earth he doesn't choose to work quite that way in my individual life, I'm assured the curse is going to go away someday for those of us who are trusting in him. And however the Lord chooses to work at this moment on this earth, the point is recognize him for who he is and make sure that you are rightly related to him because he is the only hope there is of being delivered eventually from the curse of sin. And that idea of being rightly related to him, that brings us to the second and the last point. Remember, the doctrine has been that Christ possesses authority over the curse of sin, and now the application of that doctrine is that Christ's authority inspires our faith. Christ's authority over the curse of sin inspires our faith. That sub-theme about the response of faith, that is where the application is for us. It captures the kind of response that this all-authoritative Christ, the kind of response that he deserves. And so we look back at the story, we consider these two characters, the woman and Jairus, and they serve for us, I believe by God's own design and by Luke's own design, they serve for us as models of what faith looks like, particularly faith in a time of anguish and uncertainty and suffering. In fact, we see here three characteristics of faith in the way that these people responded to the Lord. The first one is the word humility. One characteristic of genuine faith is a spirit of humility. It is not insisting that God work in a certain way. It is not saying, Lord, you know, I'm going to do this much and you kind of make up the difference because I somehow have capacity to do at least some of it. It is just throwing yourself before the Lord and saying, I can't do anything. I'm hopeless. I have nothing to offer you. You're going to have to do this if anything is going to happen. And we see that particularly in verse 41 as Jairus comes before the Lord. How does it describe him? It says, and falling at Jesus' feet. When was the last time you were literally on the floor? Not because you enjoy being there, but it was like you were so low in your spirit and so humbled before the Lord and so desperate that even in your physical posture, and almost without even thinking about it, you just found yourself crying out to the Lord in that condition. This man cast himself at Jesus' feet, and it says he implored, which could be translated, he urged, or he pleaded, or he begged him, come to my house and help me. Genuine faith is shown by humility. And we need to have this point brought out to us. Because you and I, we tend to be so slow and so half-hearted and so hard-hearted and so self-reliant that sometimes what it takes to bring us to this point is the very kind of hopeless situation that we find here. The reality of sin and the human heart is that suffering and desperate circumstances may be the only way that we come to really respond to the Lord with this level of humility and of total reliance. Somebody said, quote, helplessness is the incubator of hope. Helplessness is the incubator of hope. Inadequacy and suffering are our friends. I don't like that. I have a hard time accepting that. Inadequacy and suffering are our friends, not our enemies. They are holy handicaps that keep us tied to the heart of Jesus. We speak of handicapped people, but reality is we're all handicapped. It may be a literal physical handicap. It may be a prolonged illness. It may be a broken heart over some relationship. It may be a financial need. It may be a frustration over our children. Every one of us has some kind of holy handicap. It may be that people expect too much out of you and you have more to do than you could possibly ever accomplish throughout your life. And you just feel like you're constantly coming short, like, I cannot do this. Every one of us, we have holy handicaps that keep us tied to the heart of Jesus. The gaps and adversity we experience are God's reminder that every second we need Him. We were born to depend upon God. And that spirit of humility, we see it in Jairus. We see it in general in the woman as well, but I think even more we see a second characteristic of faith in her life. Faith is displayed not just through humility, but in her case, especially the idea of courage. You associate those two things together, faith and courage, that is the confidence to go before the Lord and plead with Him. We might call it boldness, and then having experienced something of His work, the courage to actually say something about it to other people and be very upfront about how it is that you came through, whatever it is. Faith is displayed by courage. This woman, she had already stuck her neck out to touch Christ's garment in the first place. That was actually pretty bold. given her unclean condition, given that she was a woman in that culture, given that he had, you know, this exalted rabbi sort of a position, it was socially inappropriate. It took a lot of courage on her part. And she had already demonstrated that, but it's like Jesus wouldn't let it drop there. He stops. And he indirectly puts pressure on her so that she would be compelled to come forward. And finally she did, verse 47. When the woman saw that she was not hidden, she came trembling. There was a fear mixed in with this. She wasn't relying upon herself. She wasn't sure how this was going to turn out. But she came nevertheless, and falling down before him, she declared in the presence of all the people why she had touched him and how she had been immediately healed. There's a sign of faith. One commentator put it this way. He says, what the woman needs is reassurance and confidence that her actions need not remain secretive. And he quotes another writer who said that the lady's smoldering wick of faith needs fanning into a flame. Given the opportunity, she summons up her courage and gives her testimony to her now enhanced faith. The Lord is going to press us all into circumstances where we have to stick our neck out and we have to seek him. And by extension, we also represent him before the world. And when this woman takes that step, the Lord is so gracious. As you look at the next verse, verse 48, and he says, daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace. You know, there are theologians who would want to challenge that statement, or at least put a little footnote, because they would say, her faith didn't make her well. Jesus made her well, right? We're not saved by faith, we're saved by Jesus. Faith is the means. Well, theologically that's true if you want to get technical about it. But the Lord is so gracious and he commends this woman. And faith is the means. And it is something to celebrate when somebody demonstrates that faith by the grace of God in their lives. They make that response. It is a necessary means. And the Lord wants to highlight the point. He wants to emphasize the point. And this is so condescending on his part. Because again, we could get all theological and say it wasn't her faith that saved her. And ultimately, faith is a gift of God. And so on and so forth. I understand that. I believe that. But Jesus is looking at the other side. And he is wanting to encourage this woman. And he's wanting to encourage all of us that is the right response. If he has the authority, take the step of faith. Reach out to him and speak up for him. Faith is displayed by that kind of courage. And just like we saw with the other point, typically it is the pressure sort of situations that cultivate that kind of confidence in us. When everybody is watching us, when our reputation before other people is on the line, or on the other hand, like with this woman, when no one will know if we choose to keep our mouth shut, we need to view those kinds of pressure circumstances as well as being our friends. And they are designed by the Lord to grow us in faith and to grow us in the kind of courage that proves that our faith is genuine. And finally, third characteristic of this faith, humility, courage, endurance is the last characteristic. Endurance. That is sticking with it even when the Lord seems to have let you down and you don't understand how his promises figure into your experience and you're confused about his ways in your life. In this case, it had to do with the timing, at least partially, and we can relate to the frustration that probably this man Jairus experienced. I mean, you know, you're probably going to face this tomorrow morning on your way to work. And you'll get there 5 or 10 minutes late. Instead of saying, if I had left 5 or 10 minutes early, this wouldn't happen. You say, if the traffic hadn't been so bad, this wouldn't happen, right? If people just kept interrupting me and oh, where all these people come from and what business do they have on the road, right? Okay. When there are these delays that aren't a part of our plan, the irritant that is, well, I'm sure that this man would have struggled with that. Like, what would have happened if Jesus hadn't stopped to talk to that woman? And Jesus right away begins to challenge him about this when he says in verse 49 or verse 50, "Do not fear, only believe, and she will be well." And I want you to note a couple things about that statement. First of all, there's a contrast here between fear and faith. He says, "Do not fear, only believe," as though those are two different things. And note as well that there is a parallel between what Jesus says to him and what had just had happened with the woman. Because Jesus told this woman, "Your faith has made you well." And like a few verses later, this man would have heard all of that. "Your faith has made you well." He says, "Only believe and your daughter will be well." And faith and belief, same root in the original language. It's an echo of what had happened with her, and Jesus is using that to encourage him to believe as well. This man was supposed to have learned something from what had just happened to the woman, that Christ has authority, and he needed to hang in there until Jesus worked on his behalf as well. That's the endurance or the patience idea. And actually, he needed an even greater measure of faith in the woman, because the death that his daughter went through is such a severe problem, so much worse than the hemorrhage of the woman, an entirely helpless condition. And yet the Lord is appealing to this man, just calm down, just keep walking, just keep moving in this direction, be patient, and for however long it took to get to their house, you know, you wonder what's going through his mind. It's like one step in front of the other, in front of the other, and they just got to keep walking, endure, just settle down, trust me, we'll get there. Whenever we get there, I'm going to work. And actually, when they finally get there, he has to endure one other thing, and that is that people start laughing at Jesus. And he's got to say in his heart, "I don't care about what these people are saying, I'm going to go with him." And he's not denying that she died, but the idea of sleep that he uses to describe her is to make the point, this is a temporary thing, I'm going to wake her up, as it were. People are mocking the Lord. He's got to say, forget about them. I got to endure her death. I got to endure the trip here. I got to endure their mocking. And I just got to keep going with what I know. And folks, it's just like that woman said. I mean, I've had these thoughts many times. It's what Peter said. To whom shall we go? I mean, if I turn my back on Jesus Christ, I literally have nowhere else to go. And that is the conviction that this man had to come to and to just keep going despite the fact that things were pretty unclear at the moment. The true nature of faith is put on display when you and I wait on God, no matter how long he takes and no matter what other people may say in the meantime. Somebody said this, "It is often the case that what we think God ought to do right now, God chooses to act on later, while what we would put off, he chooses to handle right away." In a sense, the juxtaposition of these two miracles is an exercise in time management where everything is turned upside down. And if Jesus had gone to a time management seminar, he's doing exactly the opposite of what they would say about prioritizing. And it's on purpose. Ultimately, trusting in God's care means accepting his timing for events. And so humility, courage, and endurance. Those are the kinds of responses of faith toward Jesus that show we actually have accepted, have embraced that he is the authoritative Messiah. You know, we have to show this in principle when we are saved, to have our sins forgiven, leaving all else behind, trusting in his promises, casting our sin on him. In fact, the word that was translated there, "you will be well" or "you will be healed," is actually the one of the standard words for salvation in the New Testament, and it's the same one in Luke, that later on Luke is going to say Jesus came to seek and save the lost spiritually. And the point is, there's a spiritual lesson to be learned from the physical healing that these people experienced. There's that application about trusting him, and trusting him even for resurrection one day. He demonstrated his power to resurrect through that one experience. Now trust him that when he says every believer is going to be resurrected never to die again, in the end, trust in him as well, that he is able to do that. And so we're left with that as one of the questions. Have you and I trusted in Christ, humbly admitting our desperation, casting ourselves in total reliance on him, embracing him with boldness in front of a world that hates him, and sticking it out with him as the only way? Have we embraced the Lord in that way? But you and I, a little bit closer to the immediate point of the story, the immediate experience of these people, we have to show him that same kind of humble, courageous, enduring faith as far as our earthly circumstances are concerned. And I want to leave you on that note with another statement that was made by the father of that child with Down syndrome. He said, "The hospital room, or those moments of deep grief, are not the time we have to learn theology. You're really not in a good position to learn something about God when you're going through those experiences. You fall back on your theology when you're in those moments, because those are not the moments I want to read the Bible. Those are not the moments I want to sing a hymn. Those are the moments I want to yell and scream." And we fall back on the truths that have already been plugged in there earlier. The truths of what the psalmists do say and what the hymns do say. The word stored in our hearts is a reminder of those good truths that we have to draw on when our minds just are not in a position to be processing. And we fall back on the theology that we have learned earlier. And so, let me encourage you today to store up the words of these stories in Luke chapter 8. Any one of us this week may be at a desperate moment like these people were. Let me encourage you to store up the words of these stories, that your faith might be strengthened for whatever distress may lie ahead in the plan of God. Jesus is the reverser of the curse. And you can trust him to accomplish his good purposes, both for this life and the life to come.